Also, what news of Fel? I've heard nothing, the dwarf told him. I've been here for 3 nights, but I don't think they'll catch him. A canny man is Fel, and stronger than he believes.
You see much, Balastar. You are no man's fool. I shall be taking Sigarni to my house. You are welcome to join us. I think she will feel better with you there.
She may not want either of us, said the dwarf. She just told Taliesin that no man will ever touch her again. She may hate us all for the sins of a few.
Asmodeus shook his head.
She is too intelligent for that, my friend. Will you come?
Of course I will come. She is my friend.
Mine also, said Asmodeus softly, and I will defend her with my life. You believe me?
Balistar looked deeply into the man's dark eyes.
I believe you, black man. I don't like you, but I believe you.
There is much in me to dislike, Balistar. I have been a harsh man, and at times a cruel one. Despite this, I have never betrayed a friend, and treachery is utterly alien to me. I intend to help Sigarni, to teach her all that I know.
About what? Asked Balistar.
About war, Asmodeus answered.
There was little conversation as the 5 men moved through the forest, each locked in his own thoughts. Fat Tovey the baker kept thinking of his eldest son, and how proud he was of the boy. When the soldiers had selected him as one of the 4 hostages, he had stood tall, straight of back, and he had shown no fear.
Like me when I was younger,
thought Tovey. Then he shook his head.
No, he's better than me. There's a lot of his mother in him, and she comes from good stock.
Beside him walked Grain the smith, his thoughts dark and brooding. Grain stood by while the soldiers selected the hostages, but he was holding the forge hammer in his hand, and using all his iron will to stop himself from running forward and braining the grinning officer.
That I should live to see this, he thought.
Foreigners riding into our villages unopposed and stealing away our people. The smith felt the shame, as if it were his alone. Ahead of the 2 old men walked the 3 foresters. Fel at the centre, Bacris Toothgon was to his left, Gwyn Darkeye to the right. Gwyn's thoughts were all of Fel. He loved him better than he loved his own brothers, and was racking his brains for a fresh argument to use to stop Fel from surrendering to the outlanders. But nothing would come. 4 lives were at stake. Tovey's son, the widow Mafri, the cattle herder Clement, and Nami, the fat daughter of the shepherd Makus. Fel was a man of honour, and once he had heard about the hostages, there was only 1 course of action left to him. It broke Gwyn's heart to make this journey. Bacris was thinking about what would happen once the arrogant Fel had been hanged. Surely his own skills would be recognized, and he would be elected captain of foresters. Fel himself could think only of Sigarni, and all that might have been. Taliesin had ordered him to lead the hunters deep into the forest, and this he had done, wounding several of them. They had almost caught him 2 times, but his woodcraft saved him, that and his fleetness of foot. What will happen now, Sigarni? He wondered. Will you remember me kindly? In his mind's eye, he could see himself standing on the scaffold, the hemp rope at his throat.
Will you die like a man, Fel? He asked himself, standing tall and proud.
In that moment he knew that he would. No outland audience would see a Highland man scream and beg for his life. Fel glanced up at the branches above him, the sun dappling them with gold and sending shafts of brilliance to the undergrowth below. Through a break in the trees, he saw High Druin rising majestically above the other peaks.
"Be with me, father," he whispered to the mountain.
"What was that, Fel?" asked Gwyn.
"Talking to myself, man. Ah, but it's a fine day for a walk, to be sure."
"That it is, my friend, but I'd be happier if we were heading north."
"I cannot do that.
I'll let no Highlander die for my crimes.
Crimes? What crimes? Snorted Graeme, moving alongside them. They raped her, for God's sake, and they hunted her down like an animal. Who do they think they are, these outlanders? First the Baron tries to steal her hawk, then they rob her of her virtue.
What virtue? Sneered Bacchus. Hell's teeth, man. That was gone long ago. She's had more pricks than an archery target.
That's enough!
Hissed Fel, as he swung on Graeme.
Who do they think they are? They are the conquerors, and they make the laws. You, me, the whole of the Highlands are ruled at their whim.
There's supposed to be a leader coming, said Tovey. I wish to God he would appear soon.
She already has, said Fel.
The other men looked at one another, then back at Fel.
Aye, you'll think it nonsense, he said. But an old sorcerer came to me and told me to be at the citadel town at dawn on a certain day. There I would see the red worn again and a sword held over the town. Well, my lads, I was there, and I saw Sigourney don the red and watched her kill an outlander. She's the leader prophesies. I won't live to see it, but you will.
Have you gone mad, lad? Asked Graeme. What does she know of war and battle? She's a child. Who'd follow her?
I would, said Fel. If he would, so would I, put in Gwyn.
Bacchus gave a sneering laugh. I'd follow her into the bedroom any time.
You will all see it come true, said Fel. Now let's be moving on. I have a wish to be in Citadel Town before dusk.
Tovey put his broad hand on Fell's shoulder.
I'm not stopping you, boy,
he said, his voice thick with emotion.
I'd do anything to bring my son home. Yet even now, if you choose to take a different path, I'll think none the worse of you. You understand?
Fell nodded.
I understand, Hunt Lord, but I killed an outlander, and they want blood. If they don't get mine, they will seek it elsewhere. It is their way. I would ask you this, though. Look to Sigourney, and help her all you can. Both you and Graeme are battle-hardened warriors. You have lived what the rest of us only hear stories of. You know how the heart feels before a battle, and how a man's courage can turn to water. You know what it takes to stand against a foe. That knowledge will be vital in the days ahead. My death may give you breathing space to plan, but it will be no more than that.
It may not even give us that, said Gwyn. They want Sigourney too. They may just take you and keep the hostages.
I've thought of that, said Fel. Let us hope there is a spark of honour in the Baron.
You're doing the right thing, Fel, said Bacchus. I'd do the same in your place.
Then let's move on, said Fel. One more hill, lads, and we'll be home.
The five men trudged up the hill, cresting it just as the sun was turning to blood over the western mountain peaks. In the distance, they could see the line of the wall around Citadel Town and the tall ramparts of the keep beyond. By the north gate,
in cages outside the wall, hung four bodies, and crows were thick around them.
At this distance it was impossible to recognize faces, but all knew the worn-out black dress worn by the widow Maffrey.
"God's heart," whispered Graeme. "They've killed them already. But it has only been 2 days. They promised a week."
"A spark of honour, you said, Fel,"
muttered Gwyn.
"Now we all see what outland honour is worth."
"They'll pee for this 1,000-fold," said Fel. "I swear it."
Sigourney, her red cloak wrapped around her shoulders, sat on the mock ramparts of Asmodeus castle home and stared out over the rolling hills and woodlands to the south. Asmodeus stood alongside her, leaning on the crenellated grey stone parapet.
"You understand your purpose?" he asked her.
"Yes," she said, her voice cold. "I am to kill outlanders." Angrily he swung on her.
"No," That is the first lesson you must learn. War is not just a game of killing. Any commander who thinks in this way will be destroyed, if not by the enemy, then by his or her own troops.
Troops? Are you insane? She stormed. There are no soldiers. There is no army. There is only Sigourney. And all I live for now is to kill as many as I can.
Pushing herself to her feet, she faced him, her own pale eyes locked to his dark orbs.
You can have no understanding of what they did to me, or what they took from me. You are a man. This whole world has been created for your pleasures, while women are here merely for sport. Either that or to carry your brats for 9 months, ready to feed more souls to your games of slaughter in years to come. Well, Asmodeer, Sigourney will carry no brats, but she will play your game.
He smiled ruefully.
You cannot play until you know what you are playing for. You must have an objective, Sigourney. How else can you plan?
An objective? She mocked. I am alone, Asmodeer. What would you have me do? Where is my army? You want an objective? To free the Highlands of Outland rule. To drive the enemy back into their own lands and beyond. To lead 100,000 men deep into their territory and sack their capital. Is that enough of an objective?
It is,
he said.
Now, examine how you will plan for this objective.
Sigourney rose and faced him.
I have no time for worthless games. There is no army.
Then build one,
he said sternly. Spinning on her heel, Sigourney strode along the rampart, climbing down the stone stairway to the courtyard. A servant bowed as she passed him. Moving on, she entered the house where Balistar was standing before the stuffed bear staring up at it.
It is so lifelike, said the dwarf. Don't you think?
Ignoring him, she walked into the hall and seated herself in a wide leather armchair set before the log fire. Asmodeer followed her, with Balistar just behind.
Why are they bowing to me? Demanded Sigourney. All of them. They don't speak, but they bow.
I ordered them to, said Asmodeer. You must become familiar with such treatment. From now to the end of your life, you will be separated from the common man. You will become a queen, Sigourney.
The whore queen? Is that it? Is that how you see me, Asmodeer? Or was it some other black bastard who named me a harlot?
Asmodeer pulled up a chair and sat down opposite her.
Your anger is justified, he said. I did not know then that you were the leader the prophecy spoke of. I ask your forgiveness for that. But I also ask that you focus your rage and do not allow it to swamp your reason. If the prophecy was true, and I believe it to be so, then you must be ready to act. A wise general knows that men can be replaced, weapons can be replenished, but lost time cannot be regained.
And who will follow me, Asmodeer? She asked. Who will follow the whore, Sigourney?
Balistar moved between them and gave a low bow.
I will follow you, Sigourney, he said. Will you let me be the first?
Dropping to one knee, he gazed up at her. Sigourney felt her anger drain away.
You are my friend, she said wearily. Is that not enough?
No. I believe what he says. The wizard said the same. I know I am not built to be a warrior or to lead men into battle. I can serve you, though. I can cook and I can think. I am not a fool, Sigourney, though nature has gifted me the appearance of one. Other men will kneel before you and you will gather an army from among the clans, and if we are all to die, let it be while fighting a vile enemy. From now until then, at least we will live with pride.
Sigourney stood and took his arms, helping him to his feet.
You shall be the first, Balistar, she said.
Seizing her hand, he kissed it, then stepped back, blushing.
I'll leave you now, he said. I'll prepare breakfast. Planning should never be attempted on an empty stomach.
As the dwarf departed, Asmodeer leaned forward.
His words have great wisdom, Sigourney.
She said nothing but sat silently for a while, staring into the flames, seeing again the sword that crushed the life from Abby, and then the terrible ordeal in the dungeon.
What kind of army can we raise? She asked.
Asmodeus smiled.
That is more like it. The Loda number less than 2,000 people, of which no more than 600 could fight, and only then for a short space of time, for the fields would have to be tilled and planted, crops gathered, and so on. Realistically, we could raise 300 fighting men. The Paladins number more than 6,000, with approximately 2,000 men between the ages of 15 and 60. I have no detailed information as yet about the Farlan, but judging by the areas they inhabit, there should be at least 4,000 of them. The Wingoras are the smallest clan, but even they could put 200 fighting men on the field of battle. All in all, perhaps 4,000 in total.
Such a total could not be reached, she said. You cannot assemble all the clan's fighting men in one place. If the enemy were to avoid a confrontation or slip by, all the villages and towns would be undefended.
Asmodeus clapped his hands together.
Good, he said. Now you are thinking. Tell me then, what is the most important matter to be studied first?
The enemy leader, she said, without hesitation. Then she faltered, her brow furrowing.
What is it?
He asked.
Are you in pain again?
No, I am remembering. How strange. It's like looking through a window and seeing myself from afar. And he is with me, talking, teaching. He is saying, know the enemy general, for he is the heart and mind of the foe. The body may be of great power and almost invincible, but if the heart and mind are not sound, he will face defeat.
She saw that Asmodeus was surprised.
Who is saying this, and when?
The king, who was, she told him. And he spoke to me, while I slept in the cave.
Now you are speaking in riddles.
Not at all, Asmodeus. But let us leave it there as a mystery for you. He also said there were 5 fundamentals to analyze before war was undertaken. Moral influence, weather, terrain, command, and doctrine.
Asmodeus' surprise turned to astonishment. His eyes narrowed and he smiled.
Did they also mention the 7 elements?
No. He said he would leave that to you.
Are you making mock of me, woman?
He asked, his expression softening. She shook her head. I am speaking the truth.
Rising smoothly, she stood before him.
And woman is no way to address a leader, she said, smiling.
Asmodeus did not return the smile. Instead, he moved to his knees before her and bowed his head.
I ask your forgiveness, my lady,
he said,
and I further request you allow me to be the second man to pledge his loyalty to you.
Now you are mocking me, Asmodeus, she admonished him. He glanced up, his face set.
I have never been more serious, Sigourney. I offer you my sword, my experience, and if necessary, my life. All that I have is yours, now and forever.
It shall be so, she heard herself say.
At that moment, a servant entered. He bowed low.
Soldiers approaching, lord. Some 30 in number. With them rides the man you spoke of, dressed all in green.
Asmodeus swore softly.
Remain in your room, Sigourney. This situation may become delicate.
Who is the man in green? She asked.
A seeker, a finder. His powers are strong, and he will sense your spirit. One of my servants will come to you. Follow where he leads, my lady, and I will come to you when I can.
Oberyn removed his iron helm and pushed back his chainmail, head and shoulder guard, allowing the mountain breeze to cool his face and blow through his short-cropped hair.
Resting the helm on a flat stone beside the stream, he pulled off his riding gauntlets and laid them atop the helm.
"A beautiful land,"
observed the finder Colorin, moving alongside him and splashing water to his face.
"Like my homeland,"
replied the sergeant, scanning the mountains. Oberyn said nothing more and moved away to check the horses. They had been picketed a little way upstream, and a sentry was standing by them.
"Give them a while to cool down, then take them to the water,"
he told the young man.
"Yes, sir."
"Yes, sergeant," snapped Oberyn. "I'm not a bloody officer."
"Yes, sergeant."
Oberyn's foul mood darkened further. It had started already. Word of his temporary promotion had spread fast, and the men thought it humorous, but nothing could be further from the truth. As they were leaving the Citadel barracks, Oberyn had seen several officers watching him. They were laughing. One of them, Lieutenant Masrick, a pot-bellied second cousin of the Baron, cracked a joke, his thin voice carrying to the mounted soldiers waiting for Oberyn.
"Put a pig in silk, and it is still a pig, eh, my friends?"
Oberyn pretended not to hear. It was the best policy. His short-lived appointment would soon be forgotten, but the enmity of a man like Masrick could see him humbled or worse. Oberyn pushed thoughts of Masrick from his mind. He had camped his men in a hollow beside a stream. From here the campfires could be seen over no great distance, and with a sentry posted on the closest hill, they could have ample warning of any hostile approach. Not that Oberyn expected an attempt to rescue the prisoner. However, regulations demanded that in the absence of a fortified camp, the officer in charge observed the proper precautions. The ground was rocky but sheltered, and two campfires had already been lit. Cooking pots were in place above them, and the smell of stew was beginning to fill the air. Oberyn walked to the brow of a hill overlooking the campsite and sat down on a rock. From here he could see Colorin sitting beside the stream and the other men moving about their chores. The prisoner was seated by a slender elm at the edge of the camp, his hands and feet tied. There was blood on his face, and his left eye was blackened and swollen. Oberyn felt uncomfortable. He had known Fel for almost 4 years, and he liked the man. A good judge of character, Oberyn knew the clansman to be strong, proud, and honest. He was no murderer, of that Oberyn was sure. "What difference does it make what you think?" he asked himself. "Who cares? You had a job to do and you did it. That's all that matters." Fel had said nothing since the capture. Colorin had led them to a cave in which Fel was sleeping. They had rushed him and overpowered him, but not before Fel had smashed Backer's nose and broken the jaw of the new recruit, Kleb. Oberyn grinned at the memory. There was little to like about Backer, a loud, greasy whoreson with shifty eyes. The flattened nose had improved his looks tenfold. Oberyn saw Colorin rise and begin to walk up the hill. He cursed inwardly, for the man unnerved him. The sergeant did not care for magickers. Oberyn made the sign of the protective horn as the man approached. He did not do it covertly, but allowed Colorin to see the gesture. The man in green smiled and nodded.
"I only read minds when I am paid," he said. "Your secrets are quite safe." "I have no secrets, Finder. I tell no lies, I deceive no one, least of all myself." "Then why make the sign?"
asked Colorin, sitting alongside the soldier.
"A casual insult,"
admitted Oberyn, unconcerned over any possible reaction.
"You do not like me, Sergeant. You believe Fel should have been given the chance to fight like a man and not be taken in his sleep. You are probably right. I will go further, though. We are all reared on stories of heroes, great warriors or poets or philosophers. We are all told that we must aspire to be just like these heroes, for only by doing so can we ensure the survival of civilization. It is very noble. Indeed, it is laudable."
Colorin chuckled.
"And then we become men, and we realize that it is all a nonsense."
"It is not nonsense," said Oberyn. "We need heroes."
"Of course we do,"
Colorin agreed.
The nonsense is that sometimes they are the enemy. What then do we do, Oberyn?
I'm not a philosopher. I live by my own rules. I steal from no man and I commit no evil. God will judge me on that when my time comes.
I'm sure that he will judge all of us, my friend. Tell me, what do you think he will think of us when young Fel is brought before him, and his body lies broken and blinded on the citadel rack, and his spirit floats up to paradise?
Oberyn was growing more uneasy, yet he did not walk away, though he wanted to.
How should I know? I think you know,
said Colorin sadly.
What do you want me to say?
Stormed Oberyn.
That he has been treated unjustly, yes he has. That he doesn't deserve to die, no he doesn't. None of it matters. The Baron is the law, he gave me my orders, and it is my duty to obey them. What of you? You took his money and agreed to hunt down the clansmen. Why did you do it?
Colorin smiled.
I had my reasons, Oberyn. Did you hear about what happened to the woman?
It is said they raped her. But I find it hard to believe. Will Stamper was not that kind of man. We were friends. I knew him.
He did it,
said Colorin.
I was in that cell. I read it in the blood. They all did it. And they cut her. And they bit her. And they beat her with fists. And all because she tried to stop the Baron stealing her hawk. Heroic, eh?
Oberyn said nothing for a moment. The light was failing, and the campfires cast a gentle glow over the hollow.
I can't change the world,
he said sadly.
Fel rescued the woman, and I'm glad that he did. Now he has to pay for it, which saddens me. But in my life I've seen a lot of good men die, Colorin, and a lot of evil men prosper. It is the way of things. You'll see worse yet,
said Colorin coldly.
Like what? The invasion in the spring, when the Baron leads an army to annihilate the Highlanders. You'll see the burning buildings, hear the screams of women and children, watch the crows feast on the bodies of farmers and shepherds.
That's just a rumour, snapped Oberyn, and a stupid one at that. There's no one for the army to fight here.
I am Colorin, the finder,
said the man in green, rising.
And I do not lie, either.
Oberyn stood and walked down the hill. A soldier offered him a bowl of stew, which he accepted, and for a while he sat with his men, listening to them talk of halls they had known or lands they had campaigned in. Then he ladled more stew into his bowl and walked to where Fel was tied. The clansmen looked up at him, but said nothing. Oberyn squatted down.
I have some food for you,
he said, lifting the bowl to Fel's lips. The clansman turned his head away, and Oberyn laid down the bowl.
I'm sorry, Fel,
he said softly.
I like you, man, and I think you did right. I hope to God the woman gets far away from here.
The clansman's eyes met his, but no words were spoken by him. Returning to the fire, Oberyn ordered the cooking pots cleaned and stowed, then set sentries for the night. Colorin was once more sitting by the stream, his green cloak wrapped about his shoulders. Using his saddle for a pillow, Oberyn removed his chainmail shoulder guard and his breastplate, unbuckled his sword and dagger belt, and settled down to sleep. In all his 17 years of soldiering, sleep had always come easily. In the blazing heat of the Kushir Plains, in the harsh, bone-biting cold of the Cletian Mountains, at sea in a gale-tossed ship, Oberyn could just close his eyes and will his body to rest. It was, he knew, a vital skill for a veteran. In sleep, a man regained his strength and rested his soul. In war, a soldier's life depended on his power, speed, and reflexes. There were few second chances for a tired warrior on a battlefield. But sleep was slow to come tonight. Oberyn lay on his back, staring up at the bright stars and the lantern moon.
He was walking along a narrow trail, beneath an arched tunnel made up of the interlinked branches of colossal trees on both sides of the way. Oberyn stopped and glanced back. The tunnel seemed to stretch on forever, dark and gloomy, pierced occasionally by a shaft of moonlight through a gap in the branches. Oberyn walked on. There were no night sounds, no owl calls, no rustling of wind in the leaves. All was silence, save for his soft footfalls on the soft earth. Ahead, a brilliant shaft of moonlight, a beautiful column of light that shone upon a crossroads. Oberyn approached it, and saw a warrior sitting on a rock by the wayside. The man was huge, his long white hair gleaming in the moonlight. He wore his beard in two white braids which hung to his silver breastplate. A double-handed claymore was plunged into the earth before him, its hilt a glistening silver, while a huge crimson stone was set into the pommel. "It is a fine weapon," said Oberyn. The man stood. He towered over Oberyn by a good Southland foot. "It has served me well," he said, his voice rich and deep. Oberyn looked up into his pale, deep-set eyes. They were the color of a winter storm cloud, gray and cold, yet Oberyn felt no fear. "Where are we?" he asked. The tall warrior extended his arm, sweeping it across the three paths that began in the pillar of light. "We are at the crossroads," said the warrior. Oberyn's attention was caught by the man's single gauntlet of red iron. It was splendidly crafted, seemingly as supple as leather. "Who are you?" he asked.
"A man who once traveled," answered the warrior. "Many paths, many roads, many trails. I walked the mountains, Oberyn, and I rode the lowlands. Many paths, some crooked, some straight. All were hard."
"The warrior's paths," said Oberyn. "Aye, I know them. No hearth, no home, no kin. Only the way of iron."
Weariness settled upon him, and he sat down. The warrior seated himself beside the Southlands.
"And which path do you walk now?"
asked the stranger. "I'll go where I'm sent. What else can a soldier do? 17 years I've served the Baron. I've watched friends die, and my boots have collected the dust of many nations. Now I have an aching shoulder and a knee that does not like to march. In 3 years I can claim my hectare of land. Maybe I will, if I can still remember how to farm. What of you? Where are you going?"
"Nowhere I haven't been," answered the man. "I too wanted to farm and to breed cattle. But I was called upon to right a wrong. It was a small matter. A nobleman and his friends were hunting, and they rode through a field and trampled a child playing there. Her legs were broken badly, and the family had no coin to pay for a wicker man to heal her. I went to the nobleman and asked for justice."
Oberyn sighed. "I could finish that story for you, man. There's no justice for the poor. Never was, never will be. Did he laugh in your face?" The giant shook his head.
"He had me flogged for my impudence."
"What happened to the girl?"
"She lived. I went back to the nobleman, and this time he paid."
"What brought about his change of heart?"
There was no change of heart. I left his head on a spike, and I burned his home to the ground. It was a grand fire, which burned bright and lit the sky for many a mile. It also lit men's hearts, and that fire burned for 30 years.
By God, did I not hunt you?
Aye, and then I hunted them.
And you were victorious?
Always.
The warrior chuckled.
Until the last day.
What happened then?
Idly, the warrior drew his sword from the earth and examined the glistening blade. The ruby shone like fresh blood, the blade gleaming like captured moonlight.
The war was over. Victory was won. The land was at peace and free. I thought my enemies were all dead. A dreadful mistake for a warrior. I was riding across my lands, gazing upon Hydruin, watching the storm clouds gather there. They surprised me. My horse was killed, but not before the gallant beast got me to the edge of the forest. They came at me in a pack. Men I had fought alongside, even promoted. Not friends, you understand, but comrades in arms. My heart was wounded each time I killed one of them. The wounds to my body were as nothing to my grief.
Why did they turn on you?
The warrior shrugged, then thrust the sword once more into the earth.
I was a king, Oberyn, and I was arrogant and sure. I treated some of them with disdain. Others I ignored. There were always 10 men queuing for every favor I could grant. And I made mistakes. Once I had freed them from the tyranny of the oppressor, I became a tyrant in their eyes. Who knows? Maybe they were right. I do not judge them.
How did you survive alone against so many?
I did not.
Oberyn was shocked.
You are a spirit, then.
We both are, Oberyn. But you have a body of flesh to which you will return.
I don't understand. Why am I here?
I called you.
For what purpose?
Asked Oberyn.
I am not a king, nor of any worth.
Do not be so harsh on yourself, man, said the warrior, laying his iron gauntlet on Oberyn's shoulder.
You have merely lost your way, and now you are at the crossroads. You may choose a new path.
Oberyn gazed around him. All the pathways looked the same, interminable tunnels beneath arched trees.
What difference does it make? He asked. They are identical.
The warrior nodded.
Aye, that is true. All roads lead to death, Oberyn. It is inescapable. Even so, there is a right path.
Oberyn laughed, but the sound was bitter and harsh.
How would I know it? If you cannot recognize it, then you must find a man already upon it, and follow him. You will know, Oberyn. Let the heart light shine. It will light the way.
Oberyn awoke with a start. The dawn light was streaking the sky, though the stars had not yet faded. His thoughts were muddled, and his mouth felt as if he'd swallowed a badger. With a groan he sat up. His right shoulder ached abominably. Rising from his blankets, he walked to a nearby tree and emptied his bladder. Everyone else was still asleep, including the prisoner. Oberyn hawked and spat, then stretched his right arm over his head, seeking to ease the ache. The hill sentry walked down and saluted. "Nothing to report from the watch, sergeant," he said, "but there are riders to the south."
"Clansmen?" This was unlikely, for there were few horses in the mountains.
"No, sir. Soldiers from Citadel, I think. Too far away, to be sure."
"Get a breakfast fire going,"
ordered Oberyn. Moving to the stream, he stripped to the waist and washed in the cold water, splashing it over his face and hair. Collarin joined him.
"Sleep well, sergeant." "I always sleep well. No dreams."
Oberyn cupped some water into his hands and drank noisily. There was an edge to the man's voice, like a plea of some kind. Oberyn looked at him.
"Yes, I dreamt,"
he said.
"You?"
Collarin nodded.
"Did it make sense to you?"
"Are dreams supposed to make sense?"
Collarin moved in close, his voice dropping to a whisper.
"He has come to me before, back in Citadel when I was hunting the woman. He told me to leave her be. That is why I only agreed to hunt down the man. Do you know who he is?"
"I thought you only read minds for coin,"
Oberyn reminded him. The sergeant stood and shivered as the cold morning breeze touched his wet skin. Hastily he donned his shirt, then returned to his blankets and put on his armor. Collarin remained by the stream. A soldier with a swollen nose approached Oberyn.
"All quiet in the night," he said,
his voice thick and nasal.
"There's the nose, backer. Hurts like hell. I was tempted to cut the bastard's throat last night, but I reckon I'll just get myself dungeon duty and watch the torturer at work on him."
"We ride in 1 hour," said Oberyn.
They breakfasted on porridge and black bread, but the prisoner steadfastly refused the food Oberyn brought to him. With the meal finished, the cooking pots cleaned and stowed, Oberyn's men prepared for the journey back to Citadel.
"Riders coming!"
shouted one of the men. Oberyn wandered to the edge of the hollow and waited as the 10-man section rode in. They were led by Lieutenant Masrick. Oberyn saluted as the man dismounted.
"I see you caught him,"
said the officer, ignoring the salute.
"About time, sergeant. Has he told you where the girl is?"
"No, sir. I was ordered to bring him back, not interrogate him."
Masrick swung to Backer, who was just about to douse the breakfast fire.
"You there? Keep that fire going."
Slipping his dagger from its sheath, he tossed it to Backer.
"Heat's a point. I want it glowing red."
Masrick strode to where Fell was tied, then aimed a savage kick into the prisoner's belly, doubling him over.
"That," said the officer, "is for nothing at all. What follows will, however, have value. Are you listening, clansmen?"
Fell raised his head and met the officer's stare. He said nothing. Masrick knelt before him and punched him full in the face. Fell's head snapped back, cannoning against the tree trunk.
"You killed a cousin of mine. He was a wretch, but he owed me money. That was bad. But it will be worth much more to me to find the woman and bring her back to the Baron. I think you'll help me. All you clansmen think you are tough, but trust me. When I have burned out your left eye, you'll do anything to save the sight in the other."
The soldiers had gathered round the scene in a sweeping half-circle. Oberyn gazed at their faces. They were eager for the entertainment. Collarin was standing back from them, his expression impossible to read. Backer brought the heated knife to the officer. The hilt was wrapped in a rag, the point hissing as Masrick took it.
"Lieutenant!"
Oberyn's voice barked out. Masrick was startled and he almost dropped the knife.
"What? Make it quick, men, the knife is cooling!"
"Leave him be."
Masrick ignored him and knelt before Fell, the knife moving towards the forester's eyes. Oberyn's foot rose and slammed into the officer's face, spinning him to the ground. There was a gasp from the soldiers. Masrick rolled to his knees, then screamed as his hand pressed down on the red-hot blade which was smouldering in the grass. He surged to his feet, his face crimson. "By God, you'll pay for that!"
"'I am an acting captain,' said Oberyn. "'Promoted by the Baron himself, you are a lieutenant who just disobeyed an order from a superior officer. Where does that leave you, you jumped-up toad?'
"'You've lost your mind,' sneered Masrik, "'and I will see you hang for your impertinence. No common man may strike a noble. Be the common man a captain or a general. That kick is going to cost you dear.'
"'Ah, well,' said Oberyn with a broad smile. "'May as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb.'
So saying, he took a step forward and slammed his fist into the officer's mouth, catapulting the man from his feet. Drawing his dagger, he moved in for the kill. Something struck him a wicked blow on the skull and he staggered, half turning. He saw Bacca raise his arm, then the cudgel struck his temple, and he fell into darkness. When he awoke, he found himself tied to his saddle. Masrik was leading the column, and they were approaching a small castle. Fel was walking beside Oberyn's mount, his hands tied behind him, and a rope around his neck. The other end of the rope was being held by the rider in front.
"'You really did it this time, Sergeant,'
said a voice from his left. Oberyn turned in the saddle to see riding alongside him, Bacca.
"'Now they're going to hang you. Not before time, if you ask me.' You always was a right pain in the groin. Never liked you.
Oberyn ignored him. The castle gates loomed ahead. Chapter 7 Asmodeer had never enjoyed great talent as a magicker. Though his powers of concentration were great and his imagination powerful, he had always lacked what his tutors termed ability of release. Magic, he was told, involved the user surrendering control and merging his mind with the powers hovering beyond what the five senses could experience. For all his talent, Asmodeer had never been able to fully release. Now he sat in the main hall, a huge leather-bound book open on his lap. The script was in gold, carefully set upon bleached leather. It was an ancient Kushir script, and he read it with difficulty. Closing the book, he stood and moved to the long oval table. Upon it was a golden dish, set on a stand above three small candles. Asmodeer drew his dagger and began to speak. His eyes were closed, his spirit loose within the cage of his powerful body, as his breathing deepened. The dagger blade cut into his forearm, and blood welled, dripping into the heated dish where it sizzled and steamed. Asmodeer's voice faded away. Opening his eyes, he took a deep, shuddering breath. It was done. Not brilliantly, not even expertly. Let it at least be adequate, he thought. Returning the dagger to its sheath, he pressed his thumb against the shallow wound on his arm, applying pressure for some minutes. A dark-skinned servant stepped forward with a long linen bandage. Asmodeer extended his arm, and the man skillfully applied it.
"'Bring the officer here to me, Ari,' he told the servant. "'Also the man in green. "'You have prepared the refreshment I ordered for the soldiers?'
"'Yes, Lord, as you commanded.'
The servant took the bowl and departed the room. Asmodeer returned to the log fire and settled himself into an armchair. He heard the sounds of hoofbeats on stone and felt the cold blast of air as the main doors of the castle were pulled open to admit the soldiers. Rising from his chair, he turned towards the door just as the pot-bellied Lieutenant Masrik strode into sight with collar in the finder behind him. Masrik's face was discoloured, his lips thickened and split.
"Good day to you,"
said Asmodeer, stepping forward with an outstretched hand.
"It is good to see you again, Masrik."
The officer responded with a perfunctory handshake. A servant appeared.
"Fetch wine for our guests, Ari."
Masrik removed his iron helm and carelessly dropped it upon the highly polished table.
"The Baron wants to see you," said Masrik. "You are to return with us to Citadel."
"I think you mean that the Baron has requested my presence,"
said Asmodeer coolly.
No, I said what I meant. He told me to bring you, and that's what I'll do.
Masrik lifted a hand to his smashed lips, probing them.
I have two prisoners with me. Does this place still boast a dungeon?
No,
Asmodeir told him. He swung to Colorin.
And you must be the finder,
he said, forcing a smile.
I take it from the fact that you have prisoners that you have been successful.
Yes,
said Colorin. He moved to the hearth and reached out to touch the leather-bound book on the small table. Idly, the man in green flipped open the cover.
Ah, a Cushier grimoire. A long time since I have seen such a work. The scripting is very fine. Resin dusted with gold and then varnished. Exquisite.
You read Cushier?
Asked Asmodeir, holding his expression to one of mild interest, while his heart beat against his ribs like a drum of war.
I read all known languages,
said Colorin.
I do not wish it to sound like a boast, since it is a talent I have possessed all my life, and not the result of dedicated study.
The servant, Ari, returned with a flagon of wine and two goblets. Masrik accepted his without a word of thanks. Colorin smiled at Ari and gave a short bow of the head.
Not drinking with us, Asmodeir?
Masrik asked.
No.
Turning back to Colorin, he asked,
What will you do now that your hunt has been successful?
Successful?
Queried Colorin.
Two prisoners. I understood you were hunting for a man and a woman.
We haven't caught the woman yet, said Masrik, cutting in. But we will. We have the forest to fell. The other prisoner is a renegade. He struck me. Loosened several teeth, by God. He'll pay for it when I get him back to Citadel.
It does look sore,
agreed Asmodeir.
Ari, fetch some of the special chamomile ointment for this gentleman.
As the servant departed, Asmodeir seated himself before the fire, trying not to look at Colorin, as the man slowly turned the pages of the grimoire.
So,
he said to Masrik,
why does the Baron request my presence so urgently?
That's for him to tell you,
muttered Masrik.
Now where can I lodge these prisoners? Do you have no rooms with locks?
Sadly, no. I suggest you bring them in here. Then at least you can watch them until you leave.
Until we leave,
corrected Masrik. Asmodeir rose and approached the officer. The black man was at least a foot taller.
At the moment, my dear Masrik, I'm putting aside your bad manners on the grounds that the blow to your face and the subsequent pain has made you forget your breeding. Understand, however, that my patience is not limitless. Try to remember that you are an insignificant second cousin to the Baron, whereas I am a friend to the King. Now get out and fetch your prisoners. I wish to speak with the finder.
Masrik's mouth dropped open, and his eyes narrowed. Asmodeir read the fury there. The black man leaned in close.
Think carefully before you react, moron. It is considered deeply unlucky to be struck twice in the face on the same day.
Masrik swallowed hard and backed away. Asmodeir swung away from him and crossed the room to where Colorin waited. For a moment only, Masrik hesitated. Then he marched from the hall.
You did not need the cloak spell,
said Colorin softly.
I refuse to hunt the woman. Very wise,
Asmodeir told him, keeping his voice low.
When you return to Citadel Town, I will see that 100 silver pieces are delivered to you.
Very kind. Colorin's green eyes held Asmodeir's gaze.
But I shall not be returning to Citadel.
Neither shall I,
said Asmodeir, with a wry smile. Masrik returned to the hall, and two soldiers led in the prisoners, ordering them to sit by the far wall. The officer marched up to Asmodeir.
I fear you were right, Lord Asmodeir,
said Masrik.
The events of the day shortened my temper. I ask your forgiveness for my abrupt manner.
The anger was still present in his eyes, but Asmodeus merely smiled.
We will say no more about it, my dear Masrik. Are your men being fed?
Yes, thank you. How soon will you be ready to leave?
Asmodeus did not answer, but strolled across the hall and stood before the prisoners.
I know you,
he said, addressing Oberyn.
You were in the fist fighting tourney last winter. You lost in the final, stumbled and went down with an overhand right.
You have a good memory for faces,
Oberyn told him.
If I'd managed to hit the Cletian with the same power that I used on Goatface there, I would have won.
Masrik ran forward and aimed a savage kick which thundered against Oberyn's shoulder.
Be silent, wretch!
He shouted.
Even kicks like a goat,
sneered Oberyn.
Masrik drew his dagger. I'll cut your blasted tongue out,
he threatened. Asmodeus laid his hand on the officer's arm.
Not here, my friend,
he said.
The rugs were expensive, shipped all the way from Kushir.
As Oberyn's laughter sounded, Masrik paled, and his hand trembled, but he slammed the dagger back in its scabbard. The servant returned carrying a small enameled pot. As he paused beside Masrik and bowed, the officer looked at the tall servant.
Well, what do you want?
Masrik held out the pot.
What is this?
Masrik asked Asmodeus.
A healing ointment. Apply it to the lips and you will see.
Masrik took the pot and removed the lid. The ointment was cream-colored. Dabbing a finger to it, he spread some on his injury.
That is good, he said. Soothing. Where did you obtain it?
My servants are all Al-Jain,
said Asmodeus.
They are very skilled with potions.
Colorin was only half listening to the exchange, but the words
Al-Jain
cut through him like a sword of ice. Standing beside the hearth, he stiffened, his green eyes flicking to Ari. The man was tall and slender, his skin the color of age-polished oak. He had a prominent nose, not negroid like Asmodeus, but curved and aquiline. In that moment, Colorin wondered how he could ever have been convinced the man was a servant. He glanced at his wine goblet. It was still almost full. How much had he drunk? One mouthful? Two? Ari turned slowly, his deep, dark stare pinning Colorin. The servant seemed to glide across the room.
Are you well, Lord?
Asked Ari.
You are looking pale. I am well at this moment,
said Colorin. Reaching out with his talent, he touched the other man's mind and recoiled as if he had thrust his hand into a fire.
Perhaps you should sit down, Lord,
offered Ari.
Am I to die here?
Pulsed Colorin.
If my lord wills it so,
came the response.
If you will excuse me,
he said aloud,
I have duties to attend to. By all means,
said Colorin. Ari turned and left the hall. And once more Colorin reached out, seeking not the mind of the servant, but choosing instead the soldiers who were waiting outside. He pictured the solid cavalryman, Cleb. Nothing. One by one he sought out the others. Still nothing. Were their thoughts being shielded, he wondered? Sitting by the fire, he closed his eyes and dropped his spirit to the second level, opening his mind to more general astral emanations. He felt the castle and its great age, and beyond it, the forest and the heartbeat of eternity. From here, it was a simple matter to find the third level. Colorin gasped. Moving through the castle, he could see the restless disembodied shapes of lost spirits, murdered men who did not yet know they had died. His eyes snapped open. All dead. 28 soldiers, drugged and then strangled. All that remained were the two guards in the room, and Masrik himself.